This is The Takeaway for October 16th. I'm Arun Vanagopal, filling in today for Tanzina Vega. Ahead on the podcast, President Trump's decision to withdraw troops from northern Syria is already leading to major instability in the region. We'll try to make sense of the rapidly changing situation. Also on the show, why some evangelicals in the U.S. are heavily invested in the geopolitical developments in Syria.
There's a fear, and we've already seen some of this happening, that many of these Syrian Christians now will not be protected from religious persecution.
Plus, how two new blockbusters use visual effects to make Hollywood's biggest stars look young again.
Both of these projects have been in the works for a long time, and it seems like the filmmakers have, in some senses, been waiting for the technology to catch up to what they've been trying to do.
All right, let's get going. On Tuesday, the White House announced that Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo are traveling to Turkey as part of a delegation to negotiate a ceasefire and settlement in northern Syria. Here's Pence discussing a phone call between President Donald Trump and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
President Trump communicated to him very clearly that the United States of America wants Turkey to stop the invasion, to implement an immediate ceasefire, and to begin to negotiate with Kurdish forces in Syria to bring an end to the violence.
But Erdogan told reporters yesterday that he is rejecting calls for a ceasefire while remaining open to negotiations with U.S. officials. This rapidly changing situation began when President Trump announced a withdrawal of American forces from northern Syria just last week. It was a decision that was widely condemned by some of his strongest supporters. Since then, Turkish forces and Russian forces have advanced into northern Syria and Kurdish forces are under siege. Joining me now for an update on what's happening are Washington Post reporter Dan Lamoth, who covers the military, and Onur Ant, Bloomberg Turkey bureau chief. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thanks.
Yes, of course.
Onur, before we get into the specifics of what's happening, let's pull back for a second and try to understand the geopolitics at play. Among others, Russia is widely seen as benefiting from the current events in the region. How so?
I think the last 10 days or so boosted Russia's role as a main power broker in Syria in general and the north of the country more than it was ever the case. That's mainly due to a few reasons led by American decision to withdraw at least some of its troops from the area where Turkish military is operating. In addition, and which was kind of an unexpected decision by the Americans, we saw that U.S.-led coalition forces already also withdrew from the key border town of Manbij in northern Syria. It's not exactly on the Syrian-Turkish border, but it's not very far away from it. And with that decision, we saw that the Syrian regime forces, backed by the Russians, took over Manbij, which was at the heart of a long-standing row between Turkey and the U.S. Bottom line, I think, is the fact that in all these areas where Turkey, our main party that's active in the area in the last 8 years, now is finding that Russia is really the part that should deal with in order to seek a solution to its own problems rather than the U.S. Even the regime now finds it probably a lot more practical just to deal with the Russians instead of really worrying about what the American forces are up to in the areas where it has its eyes on.
So who else has benefited from the situation, would you say?
Well, along with Russia, their main partners in the Syrian war, which is the central government in Damascus, I think are the great beneficiaries. When we come to Turkey, we see that it's a lot more complicated situation where one can talk about maybe some battlefield advances and possibly even a victory eventually. But it's hard to see how exactly Turkey's president could leverage that battlefield advance in order to emerge as a victorious leader at home for his domestic audience. It's all very tricky and fluid at the moment. I think the U.S. government has shown its capability to really hurt Turkey's economy and Turkey's government if it really wants to, intends to. And that could radically change sort of the power balance or the power dynamic between Turkey and the U.S. In the context of what's happening in Syria and in terms of Erdogan's standing at home.
Dan, to many observers, the U.S. is seen as having lost ground strategically. Why is that?
I mean, objectively, this is a disintegration of American foreign policy in Syria over the last 5 years. The Syrian Democratic Forces were the greatest partner the Americans had on the ground in the fight against the Islamic State. By rapidly leaving northeastern Syria over the last couple of days, we have left our greatest partner in that fight on their own and forced to find help elsewhere. We've watched very awkward images in the last couple of days of things such as the Americans pulling out of Manbij. Most recently, on Tuesday, we saw images of Russian forces moving into the bases, the base in Manbij in particular. The Americans had just left. They seemingly got their weapons and their vehicles out, but they left behind virtually everything else, more or less a move-in ready base.
And so tell me, Dan, to what extent are notions of an Islamic State revival credible, or is it premature?
I think it's a very credible concern. There are numerous reports of ISIS fighters getting loose in the chaos, mostly over the weekend, but it's a continuing concern as Turkey continues to kind of push its boundaries there. And with now you have both the Russians and the Syrian regime involved. And just a very chaotic situation in general.
Now, remind us, Onur, up until the announcement about the U.S. troop withdrawal, how was this region of Syria being governed? Who exactly was in charge?
Well, this region has been under the influence and control of SDF for quite some time now. SDF stands for Syrian Democratic Forces, and an important element in Syrian Democratic Forces is YPG, which is a armed Kurdish group, and which is at the heart of the problem between Turkey and the U.S. Because while the U.S. has repeatedly said it's a transactional, temporary relationship with YPG, knowing the luggage, so to speak, that comes with YPG and Turkey's problems with it, Ankara has been adamant that it's unacceptable, even a temporary or transactional relationship, to exist between the U.S. and YPG. And that's because Turkey sees the YPG as merely the Syrian offshoot of the PKK. That's a separatist organization that Turkey has been fighting against for decades in a bloody war. And it's an organization that's been considered a terrorist group, not only by Turkey, but by the U.S. and the European Union as well. This is the heart of the disagreement between Turkey and the U.S. in northern Syria.
So President Erdogan commented on the upcoming visit from the American delegation. What exactly did he tell reporters?
President Erdogan today told reporters that he's going to meet both Pence and Pompeo. But more importantly, what he said was this: we are going to create this buffer zone, this secure zone, no matter what. But if you're really trying to look for a way out, for a solution, here's our proposal. I'm calling on the Kurdish militants. Well, actually, he said I'm calling on the terrorists to leave everything they have, the ammunition, the materials, the guns behind, and just leave what we call the safe zone in northeastern Syria. And then this military operation automatically and naturally will come to an end. So we think that this was Erdogan's way of showing a graceful way to end this chaos. It's graceful in the sense that it would allow the Turkish president to go back to its domestic audience and say, see, I got what I wanted on the battlefield and politically, and this is how I deliver my promises, without really having to deal with an embarrassing military or political sort of show of force with any of the players in Syria. Now, whether or not that's something that the U.S. can live with, we don't know yet. When Pence and Pompeo are in Ankara, we're going to find out. But we now know for sure that this is going to be the starting point for the Turkish delegation and Erdogan as they sit down with Vice President Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
So, Dan, in anticipation of that, how exactly are national security advisors in the Trump administration responding to these latest developments?
We've seen a situation where because the president chose to pull troops initially just away from the border, and then over the weekend, completely out of northeastern Syria, where they don't have a huge vote at the table. They have a vote. They can pressure Turkey They can press for sanctions. They can press for allies to weigh in. But they don't have the usual influence that the American, you know, foreign policy presence would have. So they're trying to keep the president on a path of inserting some sort of pressure here. But the options they have are much more limited than they would have been 2 weeks ago.
Now, one senior administration official said, described this as total chaos. We've seen really, back and forth in terms of policy as it's been dictated by the Trump administration. A lot of backlash from some of his most ardent supporters. To what extent are they responding to this backlash now?
I think it's something that they're going to have to eat and they're going to have to explain for quite some time. There was a pretty broad discussion over how the United States should get out of Syria. There have been discussions for some time, basically, that the SDF would at some point need to reach an agreement or deal of some kind with the Syrian government and the United States would exit. The problem becomes the way in which this has happened over the last couple days. You basically compressed what would have been months of discussions into really just a few days. And as a result of that, you've seen the chaos, you've seen the violence, and you've seen the U.S. military, basically just quietly exiting stage right while all of these other players, are involved in great bloodshed.
What about current members of the U.S. military? How are they responding to all of this?
It hasn't been universal, but I have heard a great deal of chagrin about this. I have heard a great deal of disappointment about this. Many see this as a betrayal of a great partner who has shed no fewer than 10 or 11,000 lives in the battle against the Islamic State. They were, on the battlefield together. They were in firefights together. And to kind of just rapidly leave them alone on their own with a Turkish offensive coming is something that they never thought they would see.
How has this escalating conflict affected the civilian population in northern Syria from what we know so far?
One of the great concerns is that it's not just the Turkish military involved. There's a number of militants of sorts, fighters that are aligned with Turkey. But they don't play by the same rules. So you've seen images of civilians being basically executed. You've seen images of war crimes happening right in front of our eyes. And the United States has not been able to do anything to stop that. I think Congress in particular is in a very tough spot on this. That they don't have the usual pressure points that they would. Sanctions is one of the only options left at this point. Turkey is a longtime NATO ally, so you can try and use other NATO allies to put pressure on them. But Turkey's also got domestic politics to consider. Erdogan has been very popular. This is not a decision that the Turkish people are against for the most part. So he has limited reasons that he needs to pull back at this point.
Dan Lamoth covers the military for The Washington Post, and Onur Ant is the Bloomberg Turkey Bureau Chief. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Accordingly, may President Trump not judge by what he sees with his eyes, or decide by what he hears with his ears, or lean on his own understanding, but may he recognize your prompting and move according to your guidance.
That's Pastor Andrew Brunson, an evangelical pastor praying for President Trump on Saturday before the president addressed the Values Voter Summit, a major right-wing political gathering.
Forever and always, Americans will believe in the cause of freedom, the power of prayer, and the eternal glory of God. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless America. Thank you very much.
The evangelical voter base is made up of some of President Trump's most committed supporters. In 2016, President Trump received over 80% of the white evangelical vote. But with his recent foreign policy moves, even some of his most ardent evangelical supporters are beginning to question the president, including televangelist Pat Robertson.
I am absolutely appalled that the United States is going to betray those democratic forces in northern Syria, that we possibly going to allow the Turkish to come in against the Kurds. And I believe, and I want to say this with great solemnity, the president of the United States is in danger of losing the mandate of heaven if he permits this to happen.
President Trump's decision to seemingly turn his back on the Kurdish people is now a new test for evangelical voters' commitment to the president. Joining me now is John Fia, a history professor at Messiah College in Pennsylvania and author of Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump. John, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Why have some evangelical Christians expressed concern over the U.S. withdrawing troops from northern Syria and opening the door to the Turkish offensive?
Well, I think because Turkey is obviously a Muslim country, and there are large numbers of, or significant numbers of, Syrian Christians in that region. And the concern is religious persecution. Many evangelicals are great defenders of religious freedom, both at home and abroad, largely religious freedom as they define it, religious freedom for mostly Christians. So there's a fear, and we've already seen some of this happening, that many of these Syrian Christians now will not be protected from religious persecution.
So from your perch, would you say that there is a great alarm over these recent moves within evangelical communities?
There is an alarm. I think anytime you see people like Pat Robertson or Tony Perkins, the man who ran the Voters Value Summit that you referenced earlier, or people like Robert Jeffress, the pastor of the First Baptist Church of Dallas, and others, anytime you see them breaking in even the smallest way with Donald Trump, that shows you that this is a major issue for them. I'm not sure it's necessarily as important as religious liberty as they understand it at home. But certainly it is a top-tier moral and political issue for evangelicals.
Could you just explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, sure. Evangelicals have a variety of moral issues. They are values voters, but they define values in very specific ways. I think many evangelicals have a kind of hierarchy of moral values. So abortion is at the top of that list, and thus they're very concerned about the Supreme Court and all of these kind of domestic issues. I think secondarily, they're concerned about religious liberty at home, and what that really means to them is largely connected to the LGBTQ question of whether or not they can continue to uphold their beliefs on marriage, and you know, there's some other issues as well, but marriage is the big one, without government interference, you know, without government removing their tax-exempt status. And then I think somewhere down below, you know, in the tertiary level, or perhaps somewhere below those top two issues, at least in 2016 and in 2020, is religious liberty issues abroad. So when it comes to whether or not this issue in Syria with Trump pulling out and Syrian Christians being persecuted is going to have any effect on, you know, the loyalty of evangelicals to Donald Trump, you know, that's an open question, but I have my doubts.
You're an evangelical, but you've not been a supporter of the president, correct?
That is correct. I've been, I'm one of the 19%, if you will, of American evangelical, white American evangelicals who did not vote for Donald Trump in 2016, and I've been an ardent critic since then.
Why?
I think there's many things about Donald Trump. I'm opposed to Donald Trump, not in spite of the fact that I'm an evangelical, but because I'm an evangelical. You know, Donald Trump, first of all, in terms of character, does not match up to the kind of character that I'm looking for in a president. But I think a lot of his policies as well, particularly on the Mexican-American border, his racial remarks at Charlottesville and elsewhere, he has proven that many of his policies do not match up with the teachings of Jesus as well. And to me, that's very important. My primary criticism is not necessarily on Donald Trump. He's Donald Trump. He's always going to be Donald Trump with the moral flaws. You know, he'll be gone in 4 or 8 years. My biggest concern as an evangelical Christian is, you know, what is evangelicals' relationship to Donald Trump doing to my religious community, my tribe, the church, or as we like to put it, the gospel, the witness of the gospel? How has the the fact that so many evangelicals have gotten into bed with this man, how is that going to damage the future witness of the Christian church? So I think those are my primary issues. I largely speak to my fellow evangelicals saying that this is a bad choice, because right now the word evangelical is pretty much associated with a particular brand of GOP politics. And when you pursue power in this way, it's not fitting of what Christians do. I mean, Christians, evangelicals worship Christ who sacrificed his life on a cross, right? Didn't pursue political power. So my critique is, you know, largely of those evangelicals who have supported Trump.
John Fia is a history professor at Messiah College and author of Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you're a moviegoer looking to see Robert De Niro act in the prime of his career, you could certainly revisit one of his films from the 70s.
You talking to me? You talking to me? Well, who the hell else are you talking to? Talking to me?
And if you want to see Will Smith at the beginning of his career, there's no shortage of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air reruns to choose from.
I got in one little fight and my mom got scared and said, you're moving with your auntie and uncle in Bel-Air.
But with two big new films this fall, you can find both actors looking a bit more youthful. In this month's Gemini Man, directed by Ang Lee, Smith goes head-to-head in fight scenes with a digitally reconstructed 23-year-old version of himself. And next month, in Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, De Niro plays hitman Frank Sheeran across multiple decades, from his 20s to his 80s. The digital process of de-aging actors has become more convincing in recent years, but it still carries a hefty price tag. Gemini Man and The Irishman both cost well over $100 million. And whether films like these connect with audiences could determine if de-aging is actually the way of the future or just a trend. Bilge Ibiri has reported on the changing landscape of special effects in Hollywood. He's a film critic and editor for New York Magazine and Vulture. And I spoke with him about how de-aging is used in these two new movies.
Both of these projects have been in the works for a long time. And it seems like the filmmakers have, in some senses, been waiting for the technology to catch up to what they've been trying to do. In the case of The Irishman, it's a mob saga about an aging hitman looking back on his life. And the aging hitman is played by Robert De Niro, and the younger version of the character is also played by Robert De Niro. And I think it takes place in about five different time periods. And around him are other actors like Joe Pesci and Al Pacino, who are also playing, you know, themselves at various ages. And the film is kind of a memory play. And in that sense, it's fascinating to watch these actors be digitally de-aged, because it's not always convincing. When you watch Robert De Niro playing a, you know, 40-something Robert De Niro in The Irishman, it looks a little odd, in part because we remember 40-something Robert De Niro,
yeah,
and he doesn't really look and move like the guy we remember from those other films. You know, he was always a very physical actor. Now he's in his mid-70s. He's not quite as physical. But The Irishman does actually use him in a very interesting way, because when we see him as a younger person, he kind of feels still like an older person whose face is a little smoother. And it might be a flaw in the film, but it actually works really well, because if you think about the way memory works, you know, when we look back on our lives, we don't really imagine the real younger versions of ourselves. We sort of imagine a younger version of the person we are now.
And this is the first time you're encountering this technology, am I right?
This specific iteration of this technology, this is the first time. I mean, people have used de-aging over the years. I mean, if you remember Rogue One, the Star Wars movie, at the end of that film, we got to see a de-aged Carrie Fisher and a de-aged Peter Cushing, de-aged a living Peter Cushing. Peter Cushing's been dead for years.
Mm-hmm.
But in that case, for example, the producers really had to negotiate with Peter Cushing's family to get these rights. You know, it brings up a whole— de-aging actors is one thing, but the next step is going to be bringing back actors who have already passed away. And that's going to be a whole new can of worms that Hollywood's going to have to deal
with. So this is, I guess, it sounds like this, all these different sort of philosophical questions are very compelling for someone in your situation who's trying to make sense of when it's purely a sentimental conceit or just a shtick, and when it actually kind of in some ways adds to the filmmaking and the mythology of these actors themselves.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And anyone who has to look at these films and judge sort of what they're doing with this technology, on the one level, you're looking at it in the context of the film. Does it work in the context of the film? How well have they used it? Like I said, I think, you know, even though the de-aging in The Irishman is imperfect, I think Martin Scorsese uses it very well in the film. Jim and I, Man is a little different because this is a movie, you know, in which Will Smith plays a 40-something assassin who finds himself being pursued by a 23-year-old version of himself. And it's, you know, it's a science fiction action type film. And that's obviously a very different process because in this case, you have an actor not sort of being the younger version of himself in flashbacks, but actually playing against a younger version of himself.
Same shots.
And they use actually a very different technology to de-age Will Smith in this one. You know, in many of these cases, when you have to do a lot of digital work on an actor, they'll often have to wear these kind of like these helmets with like little cameras on them and, you know, funny suits and little dots on their faces or whatnot. And Will Smith did have to do some of that. In the case of The Irishman, Martin Scorsese said, there is no way you're putting those things on Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci and Al Pacino. So they actually created a technology that would allow the actors to just act like regular actors, and then they kind of did it all in post. But you have to shoot everything a specific way with special cameras. In the case of Gemini Man, they actually created, as I understand it, a whole library of expressions and things like that using footage of Will Smith as a younger actor. So Will Smith from Fresh Prince and all these other, you know, shows and films that he did. And they kind of created this library so that even though Will Smith was playing both parts, what's happening on his face is apparently all digitally created.
There's been a lot of, I guess, hand-wringing in Hollywood about how to actually get people back into the theater. Is any of this, you think, going to help?
Well, it does not appear to have helped with Gemini Man, which kind of flopped on its opening weekend, despite a lot of buzz about the technology and about Will Smith and Ang Lee and all that. So it really depends on the showmanship of the producers and the filmmakers. I don't know that audiences are eager to go and see this specific type of technology, in part because I think a lot of them are wondering why it's even necessary. I mean, if you think about Gemini Man, it's a movie about an assassin being chased by his younger self. Well, a few years ago, we had Looper, right, which is basically the same premise. And in that case, you know, Bruce Willis played the older guy and Joseph Gordon-Levitt played his younger version, and it worked fine. It's an imaginative leap that audiences are perfectly willing to make. Again, think of De Niro. One of his signature early roles was Godfather Part II, in which he was basically playing young Marlon Brando. That seemed to work out fine. I think he won an Oscar for it.
Yeah, he did fairly well for himself, didn't he? I mean, that's the thing. It's like with these two films, maybe we're making too much of this very small sample size. Can't help but think that this is a sentimental conceit that's not really about the art form, but it's about like these aging actors staying young.
You know, it's about these aging actors staying young. Like I said, there is a certain amount of artistic usefulness that you know, for example, Martin Scorsese has brought to The Irishman. But if you think about it, this technology costs a lot of money. The whole idea that they'll be able to do this to actors, I mean, putting a wig on and some young age makeup or simply casting a younger actor who is just as talented, that is probably cheaper than, you know, spending all this money digitally de-aging these actors and inventing new camera technologies and things like that. Obviously, Hollywood loves that sort of thing. You know, special effects movies love that sort of thing. And they'll use that technology for all sorts of things in the future. But in the end, is it even cost effective? I don't think so. I think Ang Lee himself said, listen, you know, if anyone who wants to do this, don't think of this as something that's going to save you money or make your life easier, because it's not. So, you know, it might wind up just being a fad in the end.
Bilge Abeary is a film critic and editor for New York Magazine and Vulture. Bilge, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Tanzina Vega will be back in the host chair tomorrow. I'm Arun Vanigopal. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at ArunNYC. That's ArunNYC. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.